Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Robert Jordan, who has a huge, huge fantasy series, very, very popular, called The Wheel of Time. The latest volume in the series is titled Crossroads of Twilight. Robert Jordan, prior to writing this series, you wrote several books in a Conan series, a continuation of Robert E. Howard. Is that correct?
Yes, I did.
And what kind of research did you do for that? Were you a reader of fantasy, of Howard, of Weird Tales, of any of that stuff?
I had read Howard when I was a boy. It was a great pleasure, really, to be asked to do those books. Then, having done them, I said, all right, I've done that now, and I'm going to go and do something else.
What was the name they were written under?
Robert Jordan.
They were written under Robert
yes.
Jordan. You had written a historical family series. The first book was The Fallon Blood, is that correct?
The Fallon Blood, yes.
Okay, let's go back a little further. When you were growing up, did you read historical fiction? Did you read Tolkien? What were you reading?
Well,
I didn't
read Tolkien until I was in my teens. It wasn't available.
Right, 1965. Yes.
Yeah. Growing up, I read historical fiction. I read everything I could get my hands on. I read F. Van Wyck Mason, if you remember him, and Henry Treece, and Raphael Sabatini. Any book I could get my hands on, really. Well, of course, you know, Mark Twain and Jules Verne, H.G. Wells. I was omnivorous.
There seems to be, in my mind at least, some kind of link between historical fiction and fantasy. When I was reading, as a teenager, reading Shogun, I noticed that I was reading a science fiction novel that took place in our world. And to that degree, it appears that the fantasy world, your fantasy world, bears that sort of relationship, only instead of actually researching, you're making it up.
In part. Any good fantasy does read like historical fiction, because you are taking the reader into a world that one is totally alien to him. Anybody who's read any history knows that 100 years ago, you're in an entirely different world. It's something that there's no resemblance to the world we live in today. None. About how, not the way people think, not what they did, nothing. And yet, it's not entirely made up. It's made up in that I have created the cultures. But I have to do some research on how things were actually done, how cultures actually work, to create a culture that you're going to believe is real. If I had not read a great deal of history and cultural anthropology find out how old civilizations worked, I would not have been able to put together cultures in these books that anybody would look at and say, I believe this is real. It's strange, it's different, it's not what I understand, but it holds together.
Tolkien, sort of the daddy, though perhaps E.R. Eddings is also the daddy of this sort of fiction. They set their books in this quasi-medieval world, which mm-hmm. is sort of what you've done here.
Well, no. I'm not quasi-medieval. I am, instead, rather the 17th century without gunpowder.
Okay.
If you look at the things that they have here, the things that are manufactured, the society that they have, the buildings and so forth, you realize that you're actually looking at something about 1690 or 1700, as it would have been if gunpowder had remained a guild secret of a group of entertainers.
So in that sense, you know exactly what historical period you're going to when you're doing your research. I mean, you could
mm-hmm.
broaden
yes.
it as far
yes.
as you want.
Yes.
But you want to make it consistent.
Yes.
Now, you had written this historical series. Then you wrote Conan. Then you began working on the outline, I would guess, for The Wheel of Time.
Yes.
Question. What prompted you to create a fantasy? What prompted you to create a fantasy that big? And were there any thoughts or misgivings at the time thinking, oh, my God, what the hell have I gotten myself into?
What prompted me to begin it? A number of ideas had been kicking around in my head over a period of about 10 years. One day I suddenly envisioned a pastoral village and a trollic. I didn't even know the name was trollic at that point. It was a creature who was in effect, a genetic blending of human and animal, kicking in a farmhouse door. And it just came to me as part of putting these thoughts around. And then another scene came to me, which I will not describe. But I realized that this other scene was a resolution. I realized that if the people that I saw in this other scene were the same people from the first, from that village, that they had changed a great deal. And I realized that I had the basis of a book here, of a story. So that was the genesis of the Wheel of Time. But when I went to my publisher, I didn't know it was going to be as long as it is now.
But you did know it was going to be at least five or six
volumes.
Oh, yeah, four
or five. Yes, a huge. Well, my first thing that I said to him was, Tom, this isn't a trilogy. Because in those days, that's what you published. It was a single volume or a trilogy. That was it. And I said, this isn't a trilogy. It's going to be four or five books. And I said the four just to ease my way in, because I was pretty sure it was going to be five books. And I said, well, it may go to six, but I don't think it will. Well, he was willing to accept that because he likes the things I've written. He went with me on that. Most publishers would have thrown me out the door at that point and said, you know, come back when you've cut it down to a trilogy.
At that point, when you approached Tom Doherty about doing that, did you have an outline? Had you started that? Or
I had a very basic outline, a very basic outline. And I would not even tell him the exact way that it ended. I had written it out for him and said, if you want more, I'll give you this, but this is what I'm proposing.
Doherty kind of went out on a limb in the same way, say, the people at New Line went out on a limb with Peter Jackson, just saying, go for it.
Yes, he did. He did. And he stuck with me through all this time. From the beginning, I found a major problem in that I would sit down thinking that I could put X amount of the story, because I know the story. I've known that last scene of the last book for 18 years now. I've known where I've been heading. I have sat down thinking I could put X amount of the story into this book, and then discovered that I could only put two-thirds X. With Crossroads of Twilight, the same thing happened. This book is almost 700 pages.
Right.
But if I had put everything in it that I had wanted to put in it when I sat down, it would be 1,200 pages, and it wouldn't have been released until this coming fall, because it would have taken me longer to write as well.
Eye of the World was originally only part of the very first volume, right? It wasn't even
The Eye of the World, which is where you must start. If you haven't read me before and you try to pick up Crossroads or Twilight, you will be lost in 10 pages.
I tried.
No, you must start with The Eye of the World, which, thank God, is still available. I can't believe that. 13 years in print and hardcover. I cannot believe it.
When you began, did you have any inkling of the importance of, say, the character Rand, or was he just the starting point?
No, I knew that Rand was the key. Rand was a keystone. But if you'll note the way I've written this, Rand, you can't really say that Rand is the hero. I don't believe in the man on a white horse being the utterly lone savior. Here's a man who is, quote, born to be the savior of mankind, born to meet the Dark One in the last battle, close quotes. But the fact of the matter is, he doesn't get to do anything without a large supporting cast. And there are all sorts of heroes, all sorts of people who have their stories told, because if they don't do what they do, then he is never going to do what destiny says he is supposed to do. He's never going to get there.
Well, also, I would think that in 7,000 pages, you'd probably have quite a few major characters.
Well, yes. There was a thought of that from the beginning, that there were going to be a good many major characters and a good many major storylines.
Well, when you begin something like that, let me go back to the question, your own trepidation of feeling like, oh, my God, I've committed myself to X number of years just on this four- or five-volume series.
Mm-hmm. I had a great deal of trepidation about it. I worried because I knew from the beginning that what I was doing was something, actually, that I hadn't even told Tom at that point. with most books, you think, if a trilogy is good, each of the books has a certain degree of standalone quality. That is, you could pick up the second book and read it, and it's quite all right. Or the third book. You understand what's happening, what's going on. And I knew that I was writing a multi-volume novel, and that I could spend only a minimal amount of time in any volume in bringing the reader up to speed or recapitulating what's happened before. I had the worry, a quite real worry, that by the time I finished this, that the first books would be out of print, and that therefore I might find myself writing books that I could not find very many people who wanted to buy, simply because they had no access point. The first books were now out of print, the usual way that happens. So it's been a wonderful surprise, a very pleasant surprise for me, that enough people have wanted it to keep, as I say, the eye of the world in print, in hardcover for 13 years now.
Were you afraid of growing stale with the material at some point?
There is that fear in the beginning when you start something this big. I no longer have that fear because, one, I'm getting close to the end now, and two, I've realized as I went along that the way I have structured this writing of it works against staleness on my part. Quite deliberately, I did not plot in great detail before I began the series. I have begun each book by saying for the whole series, I have known the major things that I wanted to happen. And with each book, I will say, I'll take this major thing and that major thing and this other major thing, and I will bring those into this book and see what I can do. And now I will sit down and plot how I'm going to get from one to the next. But then when I start the next book, I've got a new beginning because I have to start from the end positions of the last book, where everyone was, what their circumstances were, and I take the next set of things, major events, and see if I can fit them into this book, and how do I get to these from this new starting point. The fact that I haven't planned in that great a detail until I start the book means I'm not trying to work to a absolutely rigid outline.
Let me ask you a couple of questions, Robert Jordan, which only readers of the book will know. Was there any character that came out of the blue that threatened to take over the book? And if so, which one? And was there any character that you expected to take a leading role and wound up taking a real backseat?
Any writer who tells you that a character has taken over the story or started writing the story, or the story has started writing itself, that writer is either lying and or condescending to the people he's talking to.
But on the other hand, there are characters you invent that suddenly are so much fun and so good to work
with,
yes,
that
yes. happens. That's what
it
I'm asking.
It can happen. But no, there are characters that I would have done more with, because as I've developed them, I've discovered them to be a great deal of fun, either because they were simply interesting or because they were so wonderfully nasty that, it's sometimes great to be able to write from inside the head of somebody who is just thoroughly out and out rotten. You know, no moral qualms whatsoever.
Which character are we talking about here?
Oh, some of the Forsaken and a few others. Pedro Nial, I would have loved to have done more with him. A man who's very much in the on the side of good and right, and knew exactly what good and right meant, and had no moral qualms whatsoever about doing anything at all to promote what he saw as the cause of good and right. And of course, the horrible thing was he actually was on the side of what anybody would say was good and right. He just would. Had no breaks, no qualms whatsoever.
Robert Jordan, that means that, you know, from what I'm hearing, is that characters intrigued you, you enjoyed writing them, this particular character,
mm-hmm.
and yet at the same time you didn't have the self-indulgence to say, to heck with it, I'm going to keep that character on center stage much longer than I should.
Of course, I wouldn't. That is self-indulgence. I am crafting a story here. I want this thing to work in the way that I want it to work. I'm not playing. I am putting together a story that has followed. Well, I said I didn't have a rigid outline. I have a general outline, and I have wanted it to work in particular ways. First off, I wanted someone to read this entire set of books, be able to read this entire set of books, and find it a coherent and interesting story about interesting people, not all of whom have wonderful lives, and not all of whom will live to the end. And at the same time, I wanted people to be able to read The Eye of the World and believe that they knew certain things, and then, reading The Great Hunt, learn a little bit more, so that if they went back and read The Eye of the World again, they'd find out that their viewpoints had changed, and things that they hadn't noticed before became more important, so suddenly they're reading a slightly different book. And then they would go on and read The Dragon Reborn and have their viewpoint shifted again a little bit more. So if they went back and read The Eye of the World a third time, they would find they were reading a third novel, slightly different again, and that The Great Hunt had now also been shifted in their heads, and so on.
So there's a lot of prefiguring, some of it deliberate and some of it serendipitous?
Most of it deliberate, I hope. Some of it serendipitous, but it's nothing open prefiguring. I have fans write to me and say, I went back and read this, and I suddenly saw this casual mention here. Or I suddenly realized that the conversation that these two people had, I thought I knew what was being said here because I was in the head of this particular person. And now, having learned more, I realize what the other person was actually saying. It's something entirely different.
You're listening to an interview with Robert Jordan, whose latest book in the Wheel of Time series is Crossroads of Twilight. Robert Jordan, how do you feel about drawing it to a close? Do you feel sad? Do you feel happy?
A little happy, actually. I feel like somebody who has been running a marathon. I feel like somebody who signed up for a 10K and then found out halfway through that he was actually in the marathon. But I've managed, I think, a good time for 22 or 23 miles, and that's fine. I've done my best time ever for the 22 or 23 miles, but it won't mean anything until I've finished the 26 and change.
When you're done, do you think you'll ever go back to this world?
No.
You're going to be done. Absolutely. I will
be done. There are three short novels that I intend to do, and I will be doing interspersed with the last novels of The Wheel of Time, that are, in effect, prequels, because they are set around incidents that happened prior to The Eye of the World, that my publisher had asked about and fans had asked about, and I finally realized I could write something about those that would be interesting. But short for me. 70,000 words, perhaps 80,000. That's a very short novel. It would be very short for me.
Robert Jordan, there was a comment I read in a review of your later books that the balance of intrigue, political intrigue, and magic seems to be slipping toward political intrigue. Do you think that's the case?
No, I don't. I think that what is happening is that we're moving to a different level. In earlier books, there were characters who were on a level of individual adventure. How do I, myself, stay alive? But these characters have changed, and they are no longer responsible just for themselves. They're now responsible for larger groups of people. That means that many things have moved beyond beyond simply this individual adventure of staying alive myself. I must keep a lot of people alive. You could say that's a shift. It's hardly a shift when some of the major political events revolve around what people would call magic.
Do you think any of the political events of our times seep into this fantasy? Or have you tried to keep it all separate?
I've neither tried to keep it all separate nor tried to make it a reflection in any way, but it must have some touch of current events simply because I have lived through these things, and I think anybody puts something of what they have lived through into their writing. I'm not certain that a writer who could filter out everything he or she has lived through, just filter it right out of their writing completely. I'm not certain that writer would be entirely sane. Well, actually, I'm not sure any writer is entirely sane, but I think that writer might be absolutely Looney Tunes and lock them up in a padded cell, please.
You were a Vietnam War vet. How do you think that part of your life informs these thus far 10 books?
I find it difficult. I've been asked that question before. I think in a micro sense, there is the knowledge of what a battle is like, what it's like to have somebody trying to kill you, which is, by and large, confusion. In a macro sense, I suppose the inevitability of betrayal comes in. A great many young men who were told that we must honor a compact that has been entered into between civilians and young men who are willing to wear a uniform. You go off and fight the war, and you don't point your guns at the government and take over the government. You go where the government tells you, where the civilian government has told you to go and fight. And in return for this, you will be honored. And we came back to find that the civilian government had sold us out and that no one wanted to honor us at all. It's a very strange thing. I realized that when I touched down at Oakland, I came back from my last tour through Oakland, that getting off the plane, I had exactly the same feeling that I had when I was going into country where I knew the NVA was. I wasn't coming home. I was coming into enemy country, and I didn't know what was going to happen next. It took me a number of years to get past that feeling. I did not walk around in bits of my uniform, becoming homeless or any of that. It's one of the things that irritates me most of all, the incidence of homelessness and psychosis, combat-induced psychosis, they call it now, among Vietnam vets was no higher than among Korean War vets, World War II vets, or whatever. Yet, inevitably, the portrayal of the Vietnam vet is as a someone who has combat-induced psychosis and cannot get his life together. I'm sorry, a lot of us came back and got our lives together and just went on with things, you know.
As I'm hearing you talking about that feeling of coming into Oakland, I can kind of sense that how you can use that in the way your characters feel as they move into new territory or even old territory mm-hmm. as well. There's always this evil threat going on in your book that yeah. never goes away. So there's no coming home to that degree for those characters.
No. But in a very real sense, there's never coming home for anyone, because by the time you come home, you're not the person who left.
And your home
isn't the place you left. That's simply the way it goes. That's life.
How many books are left?
If I'm lucky, two more. I say if I'm lucky because I know it will take at least two to finish it, but I'm not certain that I can finish it in two. If I can finish it in two, I will. As I said, I want to finish that marathon. I want to actually cross the finish line. 26 miles and change, and give me my time, thank you, and let me go home for a while. I will, I hope, realize when I get the next book underway whether I can actually finish it in two books or whether I will have to go to a third. Please, God, are you listening? Just two.
Robert Jordan, when you're working in a series, this is true. Also true for mystery series or any even series where things change, where the books stand alone and they're not mm-hmm. one huge series. There's always a problem with consistency. There's always a problem with remembering all the details. In a series of this length, how do you do that? Do you have volumes at home sitting around of your world, or is it all in your head?
A combination of things. The story is all in my head. The things that are going to happen. And a surprising amount of what has happened is still in my head. And then I keep copious notes on every culture, on major individuals, and on the Aes Sedai, the women who can wield the one power and so forth. And I add to those notes as things come up in books, as I create new tidbits, if you will. And occasionally I will make use of my assistant, Maria, who's a cousin. Maria is, she does the things like write out the checks to pay the bills, so I sign them and it saves me a little time there, and she does she takes care of the stuff that allows me to have more time to write. But she also is a fan of the books, and she has a photographic memory. So I can go to her and say, there was a conversation between Egwene and so-and-so, and I believe it was in the Fires of Heaven, and Egwene said this, and I want to know exactly what I had the other person say. How did I have that other person react exactly? Because I want to do this, and I need to make sure that what I'm doing now is not going to contradict that reaction. If they were amused, it's one thing. If they were angry, it's another thing. So I need to know the exact reaction. And I ask her that and go back to my desk, and 5 minutes later she comes to me and says, it wasn't the Fires of Heaven, it was the shadow rising, and here is the scene, and she has printed it out. So that's a great resource. And between these things, I managed to not have too many occasions of Homer nodding.
Have you ever found an inconsistency, maybe even two or three books later, and you're going, oh, my God, what do I deal with it? How do I deal with it?
I have found errors of that sort. Sometimes they've been printer's errors, thank God, and it simply got by where somebody misspells something. And occasionally I have found an error. In one case, the name was wrong. It was the wrong person. Everywhere else in one sentence, the wrong name was given to someone. And I simply send a correction up to New York and say the next edition that comes out, you have to correct this. And they do. The thing where in one book a minor character had blue eyes and somewhere later I bring that character back for something and mention dark eyes. And it didn't get caught that I had said this person had blue eyes 4 books ago. That I have not done that with a major character, thank God.
How aware are your readers of that? I would think that they would catch everything.
They do. I get letters. Quite often, that's the way these things get discovered, is I get letters from the fans saying, well, you know, on page so-and-so of The Great Hunt, you said this, and on page so-and-so of The Path of Daggers, you said this, and how do these two things square up? And in some cases, they've discovered that it was blue eyes then and dark eyes now, and in other cases, I have to write back and say, no, look, these two things do not contradict. There's this, and there's this, and there's this, and you had missed this in Lord of Chaos, which provides a bridge between these two things, and you see it's quite consistent there. But they find it. The thing is, they find a lot of errors, including a lot of errors that aren't really errors. That helps too.
You've been listening to an interview with Robert Jordan, whose series is The Wheel of Time. The first book in the series, if you haven't started it, is called Eye of the World. The most recent is Crossroads of Twilight. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.